This is Radio Reorient, part of Network Reorient, the podcast arm of the Critical Muslim Studies Project. We aim to explore the post-Western and reconnect the Islamosphere. Welcome, listeners, old and new, to Season 10 of Network Reorient. Now we are on our sixth episode of Season 10. Apologies, folks, for my voice today. I've been suffering from the winter of the Northern Hemisphere, and it got me good over the last week, unfortunately. What has happened since I last spoke to you? Well, we had a pause in the Israeli bombing of Gaza, and hostages were exchanged. The Palestinian hostages have spoken of the barbaric conditions they faced in Israeli captivity. This was followed by the resumption of Israeli bombing of Gaza following hostage exchanges, which the UN called catastrophic, with its Secretary General even invoking Article 99, which convened the UN Security Council, the UNSC, in cases of emergency and threats to peace. The UNSC met to vote on the motion that there should be an immediate humanitarian ceasefire, and the US was the sole vote against the motion, thus vetoing it with the UK abstaining. On Wednesday, there was another UN General Assembly vote with 153 members voting for an immediate ceasefire, with 10 nations voting against and 23 abstaining. So today's episode of Radio Reorient was recorded last May at the International Islamophobia Studies and Research Association Conference, and ties into recent events and is akin to an international tour and touches upon many topics in the course of this tour. The episode features Saul Takahashi, an international human rights lawyer and academic who researches Islamophobia and the international liberal order. He describes his experiences with Islamophobia, starting his journey in occupied Palestine, moving on to Japan, and finally discussing his work in Denmark, where Saul demonstrated through his research that Islamophobia is racism. The conversation also touches upon Saul's writings on reforming the Organization of Islamic Cooperation in order to make it more of a force in the fight against Islamophobia. Let's listen in.
So, if you want to introduce yourself,
okay,
just say who you are,
right,
and then we'll take it from there. Then, yeah.
Okay, great. My name is Saul Takahashi. I'm a professor of human rights and peace studies at Osaka Jogakuin University. It's a very small women's university in Osaka, Japan. I'm an international human rights lawyer by training. I started off my career working with refugees at Amnesty International in Tokyo and then in London. Then I did my graduate studies at the University of Essex and started working for Amnesty in London and went on to the UN. And I did all sorts of stuff in the UN, but most prominent in my mind, I guess, is my 5 years in occupied Palestine, where I worked as deputy of the UN Human Rights Agency in Ramallah.
Thank you very much, Salman Sayed. And so, thank you so much for taking your time to talk to us about this. And I thought it just might be useful to talk a little bit about your career in terms of how, you know, you already mentioned that you're a diplomat and you now are an academic. And I just thought maybe tell us a little bit about the frustrations of one or the other, or how both of them pan out together, and something about how you found them from one to the other.
Sure. I was a UN civil servant. I wasn't really a diplomat, though, of course, I did sort of frequent diplomatic circles. I don't want to make it sound like I was any more important than I was. I was really just a clog in the machine. But working for the UN was great, and in many ways, you know, working in Palestine was a wonderful job. I mean, I feel we did really wonderful work. What happened, just to sort of give a little bit of the background, was the Human Rights Agency had an office in Ramallah for quite a long time, ever since the 90s. Really, it was a post-Oslo thing. But it did not have the mandate to monitor and report on human rights violations. It only had the mandate for capacity building for the PA, the Palestinian Authority. And so you can read into that what you want. Obviously, it was a political decision. But after CAST led a major league Israeli offensive on Gaza in the end of 2008, beginning of 2009, well, the UN Human Rights Council met, that was the meeting of the Council of Governments of Member States. They got together and they decided that the High Commissioner for Human Rights should expand her office in Palestine, and that it should expand its mandate to do human rights monitoring as well. So that was how that happened, and so that it meant hiring more staff, and so I got hired from a different agency to partially to set up the whole monitoring operation. So it was, I mean, it was a, we did great work for sure. I mean, of course, it wasn't just me. I mean, it was a team effort the whole way. And in many ways, for a human rights lawyer, of course, working in Palestine was a, it was a dream job in a way. I mean, you were really at the front lines of human rights monitoring and using the, you know, the international legal standards of human rights and the laws of war, that all the stuff that, you know, that we've studied and that we, that we've used. I mean, it was really a, I hesitate to call it a dream job because of course it's an awful situation, but it was a, I feel we did great work. So that was great. But, yeah, I mean, I felt that I had done my part in the UN and I felt that it was time to move on. I had always been interested in an academic career mainly because I wanted to have the freedom to write and do research and really sort of, you know, pronounce my opinions as I saw fit. And of course, that was something that in the UN that you really can't do. And that's fair enough. I mean, it's an, it's a civil service. We always have to, you know, act in an impartial way. And, you know, so we had those kind of constraints, especially about Palestine, as you can imagine. One of my colleagues said it very well. He was not in the Human Rights Agency. He was in a different agency, but he said it very well, which was, in the UN, of course, we always have to act like we're impartial. And, you know, we have to be very strict in maintaining that appearance of impartiality. But if you come to Palestine and after maybe 2 weeks, you're still impartial, well, there, in your heart, well, there's something wrong with you. And that was very much that you put it right on the head there.
So, I mean, this is interesting because in a way, that shift from being a public servant, a civil servant, to take an academic career, I mean, is it something that, and, you know, we're meeting here at the conference on Islamophobia studies, is there a kind of an intellectual biography that you could sort of map out from your concerns from about human rights and then towards doing Islamophobia studies? I mean, what is it that's guided you, you think? Has there been anything consistent, or has it just been happy accidents along the way?
Well, I think my life has actually been quite happy, a string of happy accidents all the way, and that's always what I tell my students, that they shouldn't, you know, get too caught up in thinking that this job, you know, the job that they get right out of university is something that they're going to be stuck with their whole lives. But yeah, I mean, in, like I said, I'm an international human rights lawyer, so that's very much the prism which I use to look at Islamophobia issues, for sure. Of course, Palestine, in many ways, you know, besides being a great job as a human rights lawyer, for a human rights lawyer, it was a sort of life-changing experience in very many ways, and it led me to Islam, alhamdulillah. So, you know, that was a very sort of easy transition, shall we say, from, you know, my sort of reversion to Islam and then my concern with rights of Muslims in Japan after I returned to Japan and also sort of globally. And so I've, you know, that was how I got into the whole issue of Islamophobia. But it, it remains the case that international law is still very much the lens through which I view this whole issue. It's not a 100% adequate lens, unfortunately. I think that's the kind of thing that, you know, the more research and the more thinking I do on these kind of issues, it becomes more and more clear. But yeah, it's a start. It's a starting point.
Well, I understand that. And you mentioned that you kind of worked with the Muslim communities in Japan, and I imagine most of our audience would not be aware that, you know, Japan, but I wonder whether you want to say something about the Muslim community in Japan, but also generally in Japanese understanding, views, engagement with the Islamicate. And you know, there have been literatures come out looking at the relationship in the 1930s and else between Japan and Muslims, sure, and things like that as part of the kind of geopolitical strategy. And there are all these various kinds of possibilities and questions like that. So I wonder whether you want to say anything about how is, I mean, you know, how is the Muslim presence in Japan?
Sure, sure. Or something like that? Well, I started off, you know, so I reverted to Islam and so I started off basically sort of going to the masjid in Tokyo and sort of talking with people and sort of looking into things, and that's how it got started. But of course, being a human rights lawyer, I've always somehow, one of the happy accidents, or one of the accidents at least, was sort of stumbling upon a major human rights case that had unfolded a few years before, but was still sort of progressing. That was the blanket police surveillance of all Muslims, at least all foreign Muslims. And this is actually kind of interesting, and I'll get to that. But basically, internal police documents came to light. They were leaked on the internet in 2010. Nobody knows who did it. Nobody knows why. But
even to this day,
to this day, nobody knows. Clearly, it was somebody on the inside because there's no dispute that they were internal documents. It's a huge trove of over 140 documents, basically proving that since 2004, the police in Tokyo and also under their direction, police forces all throughout the country, had been monitoring, or rather surveying, all foreign Muslims throughout the country. This was, you know, when you think of all foreign Muslims, this is a lot of people. And I kind of wonder if when they set out to do this, I mean, they didn't, you know, horrendously underestimate the numbers. Unfortunately, we can't tell from the papers. But, you know, we're talking tens of thousands of people, really, even at the time. Oh, yes, yes. The documents, you know, talk about the numbers of people that they've gathered information on, and it's certainly tens of thousands. Right now, the best estimate of the Muslim population in Japan is, I always get this wrong in English, 20万. So yes, so that's 200,000, about. Well, that was actually a few years ago when that estimate was made, so maybe now it's a little bit more, maybe 220,000, of which, these are all estimates, you know, there's no official data about this, but an estimated 10% would be indigenous, sort of ethnic Japanese, basically. And how, you know, the routes to which, you know, to Islam, which these people have passed through are of course, you know, they're very individual, sort of different routes. I mean, obviously some of them married foreign Muslims and that's how they reverted. Other people, I remember meeting, this was some years ago, meeting a very young Japanese at the masjid once, and he said, yeah, it was, I was, after 9/11, you know, there's all this stuff in the media about Muslims and terrorists, and I felt it just couldn't be that simplistic. I felt this was really wrong, and it looked very biased to me. And so, alhamdulillah, he just went to the bookstore and he bought a Quran, and he started reading, and the rest is history, as they say. So, you know, everybody has their different kind of route, and of course, there were people like me who had spent a lot of time in a Muslim country, and they, you know, they realized that many of the preconceptions that they had had were completely wrong and biased and ridiculous. And so,
were there any older, more established Japanese Muslim communities, or was it just mainly more recent kind of thing? Were there things that went, you know, for multi-generational, or were you aware of that? Or
there were sort of elderly. I mean, there were older people for sure,
yeah.
And there were people who had been around for much longer. But it is a pretty recent phenomenon.
Right. So even the mosque, for example, is quite. There's not a kind of history. You know, in some of the places, they often have mosques for merchants,
sure,
and things which are there for 100 years or 150 years.
The mosques, the two main mosques, one in Tokyo and the other in Kobe, have been around for a long time. The masjid in Kobe, which is a port city near Osaka, it's the oldest one in Japan, and I'm afraid I can't remember exactly when it was made. I think it was the early 20th century.
Right.
And this was mainly because Kobe was one of the ports that was sort of one of the main gateways for Europeans and many other foreigners to come to Japan at the time. The main masjid in Tokyo is a Turkish mosque. Mm-hmm. And if you go, it's also, the Kobe mosque is a little bit of a different style, but it is a purpose-built mosque. Mm-hmm. You go, you see, and it's clear, it's a mosque. And it's the same with the main one in Tokyo. It's a Turkish mosque. I mean, it is. You see, you know, get off the train station, and you say, wow, what's going on here? Because, of course, you don't expect it in Japan.
Yeah.
That was built by Turkish-speaking refugees, let me get this right, from White Russia. Central Asia and White Russia. And they came to Japan, I think, basically after the revolution, 1920s. Of course, political decisions were made to, you know, harbor these people and facilitate their stay in Japan. Mm-hmm. And they were the ones who built the mosque. And I think they were sort of taken over at some point by the Turkish government. I mean, it is sort of a self-sustaining community, but there are ties with the Turkish Ministry of Religion.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, like, the imam is... sometimes they're sent over from Turkey, and like that. So it's a, you know, it's a Turkish design mosque.
And is that community still active, the one that came from Russia?
Honestly speaking, I don't really know what happened to them. I mean, I don't see them around.
Right.
I mean, I think they probably moved on at some point. But, you know, there are a lot of foreigners in Japan.
Yeah. Yeah.
you know, many Japan is still a very basically extremely restrictive country in terms of immigration.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, we've had migrants come and do our sort of low wage labor for many decades now. After our economy collapsed in the late, basically in the early 1990s, it's you know, many of them stayed. I mean, many of them left, but many others stayed. Some of them have married Japanese. Some of them have got more sort of long term jobs and all sorts of things. And we still have people coming, of course. I mean, students, people who come under various sort of different temporary programs to work and the like. And it is you know, going to the masjid in Tokyo more than Kobe actually, but Tokyo is always a very invigorating experience because. You know, on Friday prayers, they have the khutbah, the sermon in three languages. Actually, it comes out to be very long because you're sitting there on the floor. But it's, you know, first it's in Japanese, and then it's in English, and then it is in Turkish. So it's all very interesting. But what is amazing is how international the congregation is not the right word, but the people there coming for Friday prayers is. I mean, you have people from everywhere. Black Africans, Turkish people, white Europeans, I don't know from where, I don't know, I don't really talk with them, Bosnians, Albanians, or, you know, reverts. I mean, we don't know. Southeast Asians, of course, you know, Indonesians, Malaysians, plenty of people like that. South Asians, you know, Bangladeshis, Pakistanis. Many of the used car lots in Japan have been sort of taken over by Indians and Pakistanis. It's kind of funny because we also drive on the left.
Right.
And so, you know, when we get rid of our cars, they're still generally in very good condition and they're sort of shipped over to India and Pakistan and Bangladesh. It's kind of interesting. But so, you know, they come. And just looking at this congregation, it just really, it's an invigorating and exciting experience because you see how Islam is an international religion, and it really is—it's an amazing thing. I mean, every Friday that I manage to go, it's really amazing.
This is a really interesting point because a lot of people talked about the fact that when you go to these large cities, globally integrated cities, one of the things you do see is the kind of the global character of Muslimness, because you do often see Muslims from other places, and often even in places where you don't expect them. I mean, you know, mosques in sort of in South America where you don't expect to see large, they also have the mixture of diplomatic and these kind of remnants, and these are sort of suddenly and those places. So it looks really different and it points to that kind of internationalism. And what I want to talk to you really about is one of the things that, you know, you presented today on Denmark.
Right.
And it always intrigued me, this kind of research. So maybe you could talk a little bit about that. And I wanted to really ask you whether this, if you just talk a little bit about why Denmark, what fascinated you to brought you there,
because
it's already from Gaza to Osaka to Denmark. There.
Sure.
So it just be, and given sort of the, you know, you mentioned that you look through everything through a human rights lens because of your training and socialization. Denmark would be the last place where someone who's looking through human rights would want to look at human rights because
that's what I'd
be interesting for for our listeners to see how that fits together.
Sure. Well, like Japan, I think Denmark is one of those countries that's managed to sort of build this reputation of a soft, human rights friendly country. And I mean, in many ways, of course, you know, there's some truth to that, at least in Denmark. But, I mean, how I got involved in this in Denmark, it was actually a very happy accident. I mean, I was looking at some really media articles that had published, you know, they were reporting on some of the things that were going on in Denmark. I did know, when I was in Amnesty in London, I covered Western Europe. And I did know that there were always problems in Denmark. And it was one of the countries that, you know, they did recognize refugees. They more or less abided in many ways to international norms, but, you know, there were problems, and there have always been problems, and now the problems are much, much more acute. So what fascinated me about Denmark really was the whole way that citizenship is being eroded and being watered down for Muslims. You know, they have this sort of unique categorization, even of the unique categorization of residents, and like you can be a Danish citizen, but still of a non-Western background, and this is an official categorization. It's not something which, you know, it's not something which people just sort of use in the media.
It's actually used in official documentation.
It's used in official documentation. It's in, if you go to, I think it's called Statistics Denmark, their sort of statistical agency, it's used. And now it's even more sort of overt in that within the non-Western category, they have people from MENA PT, so that's Middle East, North Africa, Pakistan, and Turkey. And, you know, first of all, there's this sort of non-Western category. It's kind of nonsensical because, you know, they have a definition of Western countries, and it's basically the EU and Britain and Australia and the United States and Canada. Basically, it's the white countries, I mean, or the countries that one would have an image of being predominantly white.
Is Latin America included in that? Just out of curiosity.
No, they are non-Western. They are non-Western, but the MENA PT, it's really the MENA PT category that, you know, and government officials are very, you know, they're openly stating this. You know, we don't have trouble with people from Japan or Latin America. It's the people from, you know, these Muslim countries that we really have the problem with. And so you have this category. And, you know, removing this category is kind of a big deal in itself. I mean, it's only removed if you are born in Denmark to at least one Danish citizen. One of your parents has to be a Danish citizen, plus you have to be born in Denmark. So, you know, in theory, you know, people get born for all sorts of different reasons, all sorts of different countries. And so in theory, you could continue forever. You could have this label forever. And, you know, there might be some justification if these kind of categories were used to sort of track and make sure that people weren't discriminated against. But that's not how it's being used, of course. I mean, it's being used as a label to stigmatize people. Now, what's happening, and this was sort of the main focus of my research, is this sort of bunch of policies and laws and policies called the Ghetto Package. And what is happening is that you have these areas, these neighborhoods, these areas all sort of all over the country, that if they fulfill certain criteria, they are officially labeled as ghettos. Recently, the sort of the ghetto terminology, which is so overt and offensive, they actually removed it and they called it something else. But in the media, it's still in wide use. So to be qualified as a ghetto, basically, you know, there are a number of social criteria. You have to fulfill basically like two out of three of them. So, you know, high crime, high unemployment, low income, low sort of educational attainment, that kind of thing. So those are kind of normal.
The normal are there criteria. Any benefits to being called a ghetto?
No. Basically, no. But the crux of the matter here is, besides those criteria, at least half of the residents have to be from a non-Western background.
And this so that's is, part of the criteria.
It's a necessary criteria. So you have to fulfill that one plus a couple of the others. So this is, you know, it's overt, it's clear. And what happens when you are designated as a ghetto, there's special sort of policies that apply. For example, children under 1 year of age, they are obligated, or rather parents are obligated to put them in mandatory daycare for at least a number, I think it was 25 hours a week. Now, people living outside of the ghettos, they don't have this. And the idea being that the children will be taught, quote unquote, Danish values and, you know, the importance of Christmas and all this kind of thing. Underpinning all of this is the notion that the ghettos are, quote unquote, parallel societies. Mm. These are communities where Danish and European enlightened values are ignored, where women are discriminated against, where sexual minorities are persecuted, where, you know, girls and women are forced to wear the hijab. And, you know, basically European values are shunned. And so the idea here is that we're going to teach them to sort of abide by our norms. And if the situation does not improve over a certain number of years, then they... The objective is to basically destroy the ghetto. So these are all generally sort of public housing, publicly subsidized housing. What's going to happen is that the housing stock is sold off to real estate developers or destroyed. The people, the residents, are forcibly evicted, and they are basically scattered over sort of to different, you know, council estates. So through doing this, basically the idea is that they have destroyed the concentration of deviant non-Western people that is creating the parallel society. And if, you know, if their numbers are smaller, then they will the notion appears to be they will be forced to integrate and forced to adopt, you know, Danish and European norms. And it's really just amazing because, you know, there's no kind of, you know, I'm not saying that this would be acceptable if these people were, you know, foreign nationals or refugees, you know, whatever. I mean, it would still be problematic, but it's not even that, you know, many, if not most of these people are Danish citizens. And yet, you know, this label of them being non-Western, that already means that they are problematized, to use, you know, the words that we use.
Well, I mean, this is both fascinating in a chilling way, because, again, immediately listening to you brought, you know, a number of things to my mind. Firstly, a lot of countries in Canada, Australia, had this policy of taking children from indigenous people.
Oh, yeah.
For similarly, you know, to educate them and things like that. And we've seen the scandal and the horror, you know, the Australian government apologized after destroying these lives and ripping them apart, because the idea was that they would be better off in that relationship. So you can see it's a softer version of that logic there. Similarly, you could talk about the way in which many of these measures, and I will go on to that, I mean, to what extent they have a broader analog with things that, you know, we associate normally with apartheid regimes.
Yeah.
And of course, the other thing that came to my mind is that a lot of the anti-terror legislation in European Union countries, which are always the bastion of, or they used to be the bastion of
human rights.
Or at least they claim themselves often involve the idea of taking away children from preventing radicalization. And while the neutrality of the legislation says that it's radicalization, but doesn't specify what kind of radicalization, it factually tends to be Muslim parents who risk their children being taken away. So there's a kind of a family resemblance of these measures. And I just wanted to sort of really ask you to reflect a little bit about this in relation to your experiences in Gaza, and whether, when you're talking about that, whether there is some sort of commonality and differences between that kind of arrangement around particular policies towards, like you said, it's not acceptable even for refugees, but for the idea of citizenship, what does that say to the category of citizenship?
I mean, I think the question of Palestine is, of course, in many ways it's kind of a different animal, but in many ways, of course, there are similarities. The concept of apartheid is, of course, you know, people sort of use this word quite frequently, and you know, finally, I would say, you know, many international human rights organizations have finally got around to sort of realizing that Israel is an apartheid regime right now, in the way that it's governing the whole of Palestine. But in particular, I would say that one sort of parallel that really sort of sticks out is what happens, or the treatment of 48 Palestinians is what we call them. And that those are Palestinians that are living within what is now recognized by many as the State of Israel. And they are they have Israeli citizenship. So it's one of these sort of quite insidious things. In many ways, well, in some ways, they are better off than Palestinians in the West Bank and in Gaza, in the sense that they have Israeli citizenship and they have some nominal sense of access to sort of public services in that regard. But in other ways, they're actually worse off, because the you know, the Palestinians in the West Bank and in Gaza are, you know, it's clear, it's obvious, and, you know, their status under international law is obvious. They are not citizens of Israel. Israel cannot, you know, demand that they take their citizenship. It's just, you know, it's the 67 territories are occupied under international law. Now, that's also another kind of can of worms, but we won't get into that right now. I mean, you know, their status right now is, as most of them are stateless. Some of them have Jordanian passports from the time that the Jordanians ruled the West Bank. But, you know, many of them are stateless. And that sort of status and in international law comes with all sorts of norms about how they're supposed to be treated. Obviously, the Israelis, you know, defy all these norms and don't treat them in accordance with them. But the point is, you have these other things clear. But with 48 Palestinians, you know, they have they have Israeli citizenship, which means that Israel has, in theory, committed itself to protecting them as their citizens, as citizens of the state. And yet at the same time, they are subject to exclusion basically at every turn. You know, it's Adala, which is the main human rights organization looking at this issue, you know, they have a database of over 60 laws that, you know, in many cases, you know, very overtly discriminate against Palestinians in all sorts of walks of life. Like, for example, 48 Palestinians, they can't own land, right? I mean, it's there are sort of insidious sort of systems in how this works, but basically the end result, and it's not just a practical thing, in the way that the system works, only Jewish citizens of Israel can own land, and Palestinian citizens cannot. And, you know, so you have this kind of regime whereby they are supposedly Israeli citizens and supposedly, you know, they have a state to protect them. But in reality, they're analogous to being stateless. And another scholar, her name is Malavi, whom I think is also 48 Palestinian herself, she's written about this and argued, she's put forward a concept called stateless citizenship. Mm-hmm. And arguing that 48 Palestinians are, you know, they are included in the citizenship regime, which is in and of itself exclusionary. So in a way, it's sort of paradoxical, but they are excluded by virtue of being included. And I see this kind of thing happening. You know, Denmark is just one of the examples. I mean, it's you know, you have these people, they are Danish citizens, and yet the whole sort of Danish citizenship is conceptualized in a way which excludes them. So by, you know, if they were a citizen of another state, that state would, you know, have the right to sort of step in and demand that they be protected and, you know, afford that kind of diplomatic protection. But because they are citizens of the state of Denmark, you know, it's up to the Danes. And this is where international law sort of ends, you know. Mm-hmm. But we see this, you know, we see this sort of watered down two-tier citizenship. And two-tier citizenship, as you rightly pointed out yesterday, I think it was, you know, this is apartheid. And really, you know, apartheid is a term that people, you know, use quite a lot, but it does have a definition in international law, and it talks about a regime of racial supremacy and the like. And, you know, whether Denmark has got to that point, I mean, that's something which I think, you know, requires some debate. But, you know, really, I see this not just Denmark, but, you know, a lot of countries in Western Europe are heading towards that direction. You know, France is an example, and it's very overt, you know. I mean, this is something which, it's something which surprised me, and I guess that's also because, you know, like you mentioned before, I'd approached this issue thinking that there were, you know, certain norms of sort of human rights and human dignity that were maybe violated in many Western European countries in practice. But at least the laws, yeah, I mean, the laws were neutral. The laws, at least, you look at the laws and it seems okay, but, you know, it's how they're being applied and what really happens in particular contexts that's the problem. But what, you know, more and more what we see is that the laws themselves, it's not just de facto, de jure. You know, they may be citizens of the state of France, and yet they are looked upon as a fifth column. They are persecuted, their organizations are closed down. You know, they are looked upon with suspicion at every turn. And this is really how 48 Palestinians live as well. You know, they are openly designated and, you know, accused of being a fifth column and a demographic threat. And, you know, any kind of organization on their part is looked upon with suspicion and, you know, very easily branded as terrorists, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So there really are a lot of parallels there. And it's very worrying. It's very frightening.
I mean, what is interesting about this is that there's been a kind of a spreading of these weakening or reconfiguration of citizenship.
Mm-hmm.
And some of it's already existed, for example, during colonial times.
Yep.
But people just said, well, colonialism ended and therefore it ended there. And of course, there have been certain countries like Myanmar, which have carried on these for a very long time, and
yep,
people just didn't know about them. But it's the kind of expansion of that kind of thinking.
Mm-hmm.
And while you're right that, you know, the apartheid is there's a legal UN definition,
mm-hmm,
of apartheid, which comes from the experience of South Africa, there's an argument to be made that, in fact, conceptually, mm-hmm. apartheid is probably more flexible than that term, and it does depend on this kind of, what do we do with the question of citizenship, and who mm-hmm. can lose it or not, and we've seen that kind of process as well, that whether the citizenship is something which is a gift, or it's conditional on your behavior, or it's conditional on the behavior of some people, but not on the people.
But not on the, not on the behavior of these, very much so. Yeah, and this is, you know, and this is something that we're seeing. The UK is the worst offender in this. You know, the recent cases have been getting a lot of media attention, but this has been going on for a while. So it's not just this, you know, this poor girl. Mm. You know, over 400 people, according to some, you know, NGO surveys, have been deprived of their citizenship over recent years. And it's really, what's really amazing, I mean, the UK, again, is the worst offender. I mean, they can do this without even telling the person. Mm. There's not even a question of due process. It's like, you know, I don't know what they think. I mean, they show up in Heathrow and it's like, yeah, hey, it's like, no, sorry, you can't come in here. I don't really know what they're thinking. But certainly the recent, you know, the Baguma cases is just really offensive because they have made her stateless.
Yeah.
And they just sort of turn around and shrug their shoulders and say, yeah, she was made stateless. Well, it's not our problem. And this is, you know, a big no-no. It really is a big no-no in terms of international human rights law, because you're not supposed to do that. You know, you can't deprive somebody of your citizenship if it means they will be stateless, if they don't have access to another citizenship. But, you know, it is, the whole sort of trend of this is very frightening because it's modern-day banishment. It's exile, an exile from the community. And like you say, it's basically only applied to Muslims. It applies, you know, it's loyalty is demanded of some people and loyalty is assumed of everybody else. And if, you know, basically the Muslims have to prove their loyalty at each and every turn. And if they can't do it to the satisfaction of the government, well, you know, off they go. And it's really a very frightening trend.
Yeah. I mean, what's interesting is that kind of behavior around the kind of fragility of citizenship was to be often associated with totalitarian regimes.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, both Nazi Germany and Stalinist Russia were the ones who were considered to be the ones who would play around with citizenship and into banishment and things like that. And of course, it was condemned.
Yeah.
And many of the kind of infrastructures around, for example, children being asked to spy on their parents and family members and things like that. I mean, that again has become normalized through that kind of arrangement of the war on terror, which it becomes permissible. And I guess the issue really is this, that there was this kind of very happy narrative that you had, that you had the Western countries who were custodians of human dignity.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, you know, like any humans, they slipped up occasionally. But eventually you would go to the highest court in the land, and these wise men, and they normally would be wise men, would rule in a way, and you make a Hollywood movie out of it, which would restore the idea of the constitution or whatever arrangement would be, and freedom would be completely protected eventually through that and the narrative. Now, what is, as you mentioned, is what is frightening is that these established, self-confessed liberal democracies are playing around with this, and in some cases, of course, in Britain is overtly now saying that it will not. It will leave some of the human rights.
Very frightening stuff.
Very frightening stuff and things like that. So I think that leads me to really the question, one of the things I wanted to ask you. You wrote a paper, which I found really, really interesting, because it was about the question about a kind of a Muslim unity and the possibility of putting some sort of block. And then this, and I guess one of the things is that in this kind of world of Islamophobia, where is it that you could have a countervailing forces around it, or countervailing spaces, or even insulated or safe spaces for Muslims in a way? And I guess there's a number of questions. So firstly, I'd like you to talk a little bit about what drove you to writing that, because again, it is something that is greeted with a great deal of cynicism now at the same time, because look at the record, and you know, you could talk about the OIC and see, you know, what is the OIC for? But at the same time, we know that there have been successful, at least at the economic level, associations like ASEAN and, of course, the European Union itself and their various configurations of that. So perhaps you can firstly talk a little bit about what made you write this and then talk a little bit about what your main kind of proposal.
What's it about?
And then we can have a much more conversation about how is it possible to get there or not?
How is it possible to get there? That's a whole other a whole other thing, I guess. But Yeah, I mean, it started out mainly because I was invited to speak at the Kuala Lumpur Summit in 2019, and I felt that it was a great opportunity to sort of really sit down and start thinking about some of the ideas that I had, sort of the notions that I had, and sort of turn them into ideas, and then, you know, maybe later on they could turn into concepts, or I don't even know the order of that. But it's, you know, of course, being a human rights lawyer, and again, starting out as a refugee lawyer, I've always been very conscious of these kind of things about citizenship, about passports, about borders. You know, these are the sort of defining features of international human rights law, of refugee law, and of international law in general. The whole current system, international system, is based on sovereign states, and it's the state that protects you and protects your human rights and ensures your rights. That's how it's supposed to work. And, you know, refugees are people who cannot avail themselves of the protection of their state, and they're in big trouble. But even more trouble are the stateless people, the people who have, you know, they have had their citizenship stripped, and under the international system, there's nobody to protect them. And that is, you know, that is it's in a real serious situation. You know, the people that are worse off than the refugees, the only people that are really worse off than refugees are stateless people, arguably. And, you know, at the same time, though, you know, this is all, it's a legal fiction. I mean, we talk about borders and we look at maps and, you know, there are all these sort of red lines on these maps, but it's like, you go to these places and, you know, they're not there. These are all artificial things, artificial concepts. I remember, I was working for Amnesty in London at the time, I think. I was watching, I think it was BBC, and there was a journalist walking, he was talking about sort of the refugees coming to Western Europe through Austria, or I guess the Czech Republic, actually. And he's walking in the forest, and he's just sort of walking straight towards the camera, and he said, okay, right now, I'm in Germany. And then he takes one step to the left and says, now I'm in the Czech Republic. And then he steps back and said, now I'm back in Germany. What I just did was illegal. I committed the offense of illegal entry. And, you know, that I remember that to this day, because it was a really good way of showing just how artificial all these things are and how it's necessary to transcend the nation state and these, you know, these kind of exclusionary concepts. Now, you know, I'm an international lawyer, and I was an international civil servant for a long time, and I know this is, you know, this is how the system works right now. So, you know, it's an uphill struggle, but I do feel that it's important that we think in terms of transcending the nation state and transcending these kind of, you know, inward looking sort of borders and imagined communities that we have. And, you know, that's where I've always felt that the Ummah, as a religious community, should transcend the nation state, and that we could create this kind of, I think you called it the Muslim space, this kind of space where Muslims could automatically be given protection. And, you know, the closest analogy that I actually have is the EU. And the EU is, you know, make no mistake, of course, Britain has left, so, you know, that's a whole different kind of word. But, you know, it is an amazing achievement. You know, I lived in Vienna for a while, and that was right after the Czech Republic and the Slovak Republic, and Slovakia had joined, and Hungary joined. Anyway, so the Austrian sort of shop opening hours were still very restrictive, and Sunday everything was closed. So, but the neighboring countries, they sort of liberalized that kind of thing. So they had these huge Tescos sort of near the border. And it would be like a shopping trip on a Sunday. You drive across the border and go to Tesco's, and, you know, they hadn't joined the euro yet, so you would use, like in Hungary's case, you would use a florin, and you would, you know, stock up on stuff which you couldn't buy on Saturday. You just drive back. But I remember one day I was driving back from Hungary, and this was, you know, it was a recent thing that they had joined Schengen, so it was, you know, the border structures were still there, and some of the border guards were milling around, but you just drove through. And, I was thinking, you know, in my living memory, you know, people were shot trying to cross this border. And now it's a day trip. It's a shopping trip. And, you know, really, it's an amazing achievement that you have this block of many countries where, you know, citizenship offers you, gives you the right to just, you know, pack up your bags, move next door or move, you know, across the EU. Just put your bags down and you can live, you can work, you can do whatever you want. And that really is an amazing achievement. Because, you know, it's not the kind of thing which, there are sort of isolated examples of those kind of things. But for it to have lasted this long and in a very sort of prosperous way and to expand, it really is it's an amazing achievement, I think. And that's the kind of, you know, the states are still sovereign states. And, you know, you see that in, for example, law enforcement and, of course, COVID. Then all of a sudden they did sort of, you know, do some semblance of border control now and then. Though I think, as an EU citizen, you still had the right to go. It's just that they had the right to stop you. But if you can show that you're an EU citizen and that you're not involved in, you know, like drug trafficking or anything, then you have the right to sort of pass. But it is an amazing achievement, and that's the kind of sort of, not necessarily the end goal, but it's certainly one of the, that's how I see the Ummah developing. Inshallah, I mean, it's you know, it's very much a sort of dream of mine, but I think that's the kind of model that it would be great to see. If you are an EU, like if you're a citizen of, I don't know, of Hungary, and for whatever reason, and I apologize to anybody from Hungary who's listening, it doesn't have to be Hungary, it could be Poland, it could be anywhere, it can be Austria, it can be Germany, it could be France, you know, and let's take France, actually, that's actually a really good example, because if you, for example, if you are a Muslim, and you are persecuted, you're a French citizen, you are persecuted in France. You, as somebody who is persecuted for their religion, you have the right to apply for refugee status in other countries. But in the EU, you don't have to do that. You just move over to Germany, or you move over to Italy, and you have the right to move. And you plop your stuff down, and that's it. I'm not saying that's what people should do. You know, they should, I'm not saying they should, but if people want to resist, then, you know, I definitely encourage that. But you have the right to do that. And that's what I see as important for the Ummah. You know, you have huge refugee flows coming from a lot of Muslim countries, you know, Syria, Iraq, Afghanistan, you know, these kind of countries. And when they, obviously most of them go to neighboring countries, which in many cases are Muslim countries. Many of them end up in Turkey, that's also a Muslim country, and there are also sort of issues with that too. But, you know, many of them, if they are setting out for Western Europe, then they have these, they're blocked, they're excluded. And, you know, if they could have the right as a Muslim citizen, if you like, I'm sort of using this word citizen in a kind of different way, to just plop up their, you know, just pack up their stuff and move to a different country within the Ummah, then I think that would be, you know, that would be a great thing, and that's an amazing thing. That would, I think that's one way that we could transcend the current nation state.
So, I mean, you know, someone would turn around, well, we've, the Ummah, or at least Muslim, the 54 countries which themselves have the aura of the amazing organization.
Yes, the amazing.
You know, the OIC. What do you think would what do you think would be needed to make that or effective, or do you think that's a hopeless task? And you, because what you're asking for, suggesting, you know, quite radical reforms. Radical in the sense that you're talking about the freedom of movement. You're talking about certain kind of commitments. You're talking about a pooling of sovereignty in particular areas.
Yes.
So. Now, as you point out, the remarkable achievement of the European Union is that if you think about the European Union, which is the Treaty of Rome, that's, you know, that's almost 11-12 years after the Second World War,
right,
where France and Germany, within the last 70 years, had gone to war, killed millions of people, occupied each other's territory, and then they're able to come together to build up this incredible community, institution. So the idea that violence or friction prevent is an obstacle doesn't seem to apply, historical obstacles. So what do you think, do you think the OIC is something that could be rescued and what would it be? Or are you thinking that this would have to be a different kind of arrangement? Where would you stand on that?
I don't know if the OIC can be rescued. I mean, I'm of two minds of that. The sort of revolutionary in me says we need something completely new and we need to destroy what we have and build something new. But the more sort of practical former UN civil servant in me says, look, we have something, maybe we should build on it. I'm of two minds of it, and I don't really have a conclusion that I can give you now. But I think one of the things that has to be done is there has to be a greater voice for Muslim citizenry. And I'm thinking in terms of like a social movement, a broad-based social movement. And that's one of the things that the OIC has been quite bad at. The UN has been maybe a little bit better, but not certainly not 100%. That's one of the problems of the international law. It is it's the states, the representative of states that get together. They make the rules. And I think what I've been talking about freedom of movement and pooling of sovereignty and a general sort of greater sense of solidarity, I think it's shared at the level of the Ummah, the people of the Ummah. To greater and lesser degrees. I think it's mainly the leaders of many of the states that, you know, they have investments, in many times literal, in keeping the status quo and in keeping these kind of exclusionary spaces where they can, you know, be the big kid on the block and do what they want. But it really is, you know, it's the people. It's the people of the Ummah that I think are more... You know, they share these ideals and they share these values and they share this is something that they would want. So I think it's, you know, I think it's about creating a social movement to sort of demand this of the governments of the Ummah and to bring that about. It's revolutionary, I know. It's not something which would probably happen, you know, immediately. But, of course, we said that about the Berlin Wall. You know, nobody saw the Berlin Wall coming down until it did. And nobody saw the quote-unquote Arab Spring until all of a sudden it happened. And that's the amazing thing about our world. You know, it happens slowly and then it happens all of a sudden, like they say. So it's, I think that's the key. I think that is the key to creating a broad-based social movement demanding these things of their government.
So what was the response when you gave this talk in Kuala Lumpur at the conference? Was it bemused sort of cynicism or enthusiasm?
well, the people who came up to me said that it sounded great and they were very appreciative and they were very happy. There were ministers from the Malaysia, certainly, I remember on my panel, I think there was a former foreign minister of Malaysia, or maybe he was the current one, and he seemed very impressed and he liked the idea. I don't know if anything concrete has happened within their hallways about it. And of course, you know, then we had COVID quite soon, and then there were various sort of political scandals within Malaysia. So, you know, I don't know that anything has really happened. I mean, it doesn't necessarily have to be Malaysia that leads this process, but certainly it's one of the countries that I would look to, hopefully, to exercise leadership.
One of the key points you've talked about is really, and you put it better than I could put it here, but really about the difference between countries in which the citizenry or the population or the people have a strong input into this to me. And I think one of the things about, and this is perhaps as well, we'll sort of finish with there, because one of the things, of course, is that there's a tendency sometimes in looking at international human rights and international law to treat all political problems as legalistic problems in a sense that you can it's liberalism for all kind of thing, that you can resolve these things through basically a rational application of sensible, neutral things. And as you mentioned already, that once you get down to it, there's an element that the law itself is an instrument of domination and things like that. So I guess with your experience of working in sort of both sort of academia and in these international institutions, is there one effective or one measure that you think the OIC could take? And to be honest with you, the question is that it's not really about, I suppose, the measures. It's like you said, it's generating the political will, and therefore the differences between the OIC seems to be that there are countries which are more prone to being affected by their citizenship than others, and that makes a huge difference in how it can operate as an organization. I mean, that's, you know, many international organizations are often even the are often removed from the citizenship, but there's a sense in which there is some kind of implicit support for integration, let's say, however it manifests itself. Sure. So do you see any kind of, would you want to...
I mean, I think, you know, the UN, for all its faults, has made great progress in ensuring some kind of space, I mean, at least certainly in the human rights field, for civil society, from, you know, for civil society to come and express their views. You know, human rights treaties, for example, state parties have to provide that there's a periodic review. The periodic review become the UPR, the state reporting of how they are implementing these human rights within their jurisdictions. And on those, so that's like a regular thing. It depends on the convention. Usually it's like every 4 years or 5 years or like that. And on that occasion, so the state comes to Geneva and they present a report. And the report, of course, is, you know, pretty, it leaves out a lot of stuff. So those committees, for example, allow NGOs as well to provide what are called, you know, shadow reports or alternative information or, you know, all that kind of stuff. And these committees, they look at both. I mean, they are made up of, generally, of human rights scholars. They're independent committees. They do not report to any government. And, you know, they review the performance of state parties in very sort of stringent and strict ways. They take, you know, the NGO reports very seriously. And they, you know, they issue final recommendations on, and most of those, you know, those recommendations would not be possible without the input of civil society. So, you know, that's, it's not a perfect system. Those recommendations are not legally binding in a very strict sense. Many governments just ignore them. So, you know, that's one problem. Another problem is, of course, when you have countries where civil society is very weak or basically non-existent because the government doesn't allow it, then, you know, you have this problem. I mean, there are, in most countries, with most countries, like, there would be international human rights NGOs like Amnesty or Human Rights Watch or FIDH that are looking at the situation within that country from the outside. And they provide reports to these committees, and that's very important, but it's not perfect, because, you know, you want people of that country in that country. You want the voice of really the people who, you know, the residents and the citizens of that country. So that's what's kind of important. It's not perfect, but it's still something. And the UN, certainly within the realm of human rights in particular, has made a lot of progress in being open and making sure that the views of civil society are reflected. So, you know, I think the OIC, that's something the OIC could definitely benefit from. That's something that should definitely improve. Again, you know, you have countries that are relatively open to civil society in the OIC, and you have countries where it's kind of a disaster. So, you know, that in and of itself does not get over this fundamental problem, but it's a start. It could be a step in the right direction, for sure. And the other thing about, you know, about the OIC is certainly in the realm of human rights, it's still very much, a lot of times, you know, the OIC is actually a very powerful lobbying bloc within the UN. I mean, you know, they get together in OIC position, they go to the Human Rights Council and other human rights bodies, and they lobby for stuff. The problem is, a lot of times, with the stuff that they lobby for is not that great. You know, it's still very caught up in the sort of, you know, international human rights standards are Western, and they're Eurocentric, and they are, you know, they're tools of Western colonialism, this kind of narrative. And there's a lot of truth to that. I'm not denying that. Certainly, if you look at the history of human rights, which is something that I've been doing, I mean, there are a lot of arguments for that. But at the same time, you know, governments have to understand that for the vast majority of the population in the OIC countries, you know, international human rights standards, with perhaps some exceptions on particular issues, you know, by and large, they are accepted, and everybody recognizes them as important. Everybody wants the protection, you know, their human rights protected. And so, again, it's that voice of the citizenry, it's the voice of the people that have to be reflected in all of this. But that's something that you know, I think greater involvement of civil society could help change. And the OIC has to get over these kind of trying to demean human rights kind of approaches that it often takes in the UN.
So thank you so much. I guess I want to finish on a final point is that what are you working on next, or what are you, you want to share anything with our listeners about what your next project might be or what you're working on?
Well, actually, I've just finished a chapter for a book. It's a book project that I've been working on with many other people about the how international law has developed in an inherently racist way. I'm sure you'd be very interested in it. I wrote the chapter on Japan, and it is I had a general sort of understanding of it, but it required me to do a lot of reading up on some of the things, some of the details. And it was it is very interesting. I mean, Japan, in our period of modernization, we basically imported white supremacist ideas from Europe wholesale. And, but those just, sort of translating those into Japanese and using them wasn't really so great, because it meant that as Asians, we were also inferior to the white people and that we were going to be subjugated just like everybody else was. So this wasn't so great. So, we developed these notions of us being the civilized, hardworking, industrious people within the Asian race, and this kind of sort of differentiation between race and folk, what I might translate as folk, this began to ensue, and this also led to our kind of racist or supremacist notion towards other Asians, Koreans in particular, Koreans and Chinese in particular, and it is a fascinating process, and one which we see still remains now in Japan in the attitudes towards China, the ethnic Korean minority within Japan, and also migrant workers, in particular from Asia. And you can see how these kind of sort of supremacist notions play out.
This has been an episode of Radio Reorient, brought to you by Network Reorient, part of the Critical Muslim Studies Project. Your host has been Hiza Mir, and the episode has been sound engineered by Zubair Vakil. Thank you for tuning in. Have a listen to our other episodes, and please leave a like and a rating.